You're listening to the Reinvention Project with Jim Rome podcast. Welcome to episode 85 of the Reinvention Project with Jim Rome. Hope you've all identified what your mission is. You're obsessed with that mission, and every thought, decision, and action that you have or make is aligned with that mission. And if you haven't figured out yet what your mission is, then you better get obsessed with determining what that mission is, because without it, you're just floating, untethered, and you're not only not working towards anything significant, but you're probably not working towards anything at all. For instance, how can you be great at something if you're not locked in and working towards anything at all? Remember, identify your particular mission, become obsessed with executing on and making that mission a reality, and develop the discipline to ensure that every thought, choice, and action are in alignment with that mission. You do that consistently enough, and suddenly all these thoughts and decisions that used to be so hard become easy because it's binary. Then it's habitual. If it's in accordance with the mission, you just do it. If not, you don't do it. It literally is that black and white. It's that cut and dried. That's my approach, and it's working. Now, what's not easy is if you get knocked off the path. And I don't mean knocked down, where you get right back up and you rejoin the fight. I mean knocked the hell off the path. And you have your world turned completely upside down by some unforeseeable crisis or traumatic event. An event so catastrophic that not only can you not get back on the path, but you literally can't get back up. You can't figure out how to take even one step, or how you're going to get through the next hour, much less the next day, or month, or year. The type of catastrophe that can break you and destroy you physically and mentally, maybe even your will to live. Now, obviously, I am not a mental health expert, and if you're dealing with something that traumatic, you need to seek out a professional. However, if something incredibly traumatic did happen to you, and you're not sure where to turn or where to go, this app might be able to spur you on to some action. Then I am comfortable in saying you absolutely need to hear this episode, as this episode's guest experienced every parent's worst nightmare, the loss of a beloved child. My guest, Stephen Panis, lost his 16-year-old son, Jake, in a senseless drunk driving accident, sending him and his family into a downward spiral and extreme despair. Stephen shares his story and describes how he and his family were able to crawl out of the depths of hell to carry on Jake's legacy and to help others who are dealing with similar traumatic episodes in their lives. It's a story of grief and what to do with it, and of turning pain into purpose, a story of love and gratitude. And I can't wait to get to that conversation and share that with you. Before I do so, though, I want to share something personal with you about grief and loss and gratitude as well. Some of you know this story, but many of you probably don't. I lost my father, Jay Rome, to cancer in 1992. He was 60, just a little bit older than I am right now. And he'd been diagnosed with leukemia a decade earlier. Remember, he was diagnosed in the early 80s, so we didn't know nearly as much about the disease as we do right now. I was 28. My mother, Jan, who ran the family business along with my father, was in her early 50s. And I will never forget the two of them pulling my sister and I aside and telling us Jay had leukemia and that we were not to tell anybody, nobody. That they were not telling their parents or customers or employees, and we were not to tell any of our friends or anybody else. Like, I was in shock. I could not believe what I was hearing. I was actually reeling and had so many questions. At that time, I didn't really ever know of anybody who had cancer, so I didn't fully understand just how insidious the disease was. But I was in complete shock that my father had been diagnosed with it because I was naive and because he was a tough, tough Boston dude who never, ever complained about anything and seemed pretty healthy. But of course, as we all know, cancer does not discriminate, and it sure as hell does not give a damn. So the diagnosis was shocking and it was scary, but I really couldn't get my head wrapped around this notion that none of us were ever going to tell anybody. My parents told us that as a family, we could talk about it as much as we wanted to, but we were not to discuss it outside these four walls. Ultimately, I had to respect their choice because it was my father who was ill, and this was their cross. the cross that he and my mother had to bear. And who was I to judge or to say how to handle something like that? And they were in Los Angeles, and I was in San Diego. But I remember thinking, how the hell could you keep something like that secret? But in retrospect, my father did not want any pity. He didn't want anybody to feel sorry for him. He didn't want to ever make anything about himself. And he loved his company, the company that he and my mother built for themselves, and he didn't want any of his customers or any of his employees to lose any confidence in his ability to run that company or in him. And frankly, I think that he and my mother just decided it's nobody's business. This is private, and we've got this. So now we're living with this secret, incredibly. And my parents are living their lives, and they're running their business, and incredibly, they were able to keep it a secret for a pretty long time. As everybody listening knows, because by now everybody's either experienced cancer, or knows somebody close to them who has, or knows somebody who has, we all know how terrifying it is. So we would ride that roller coaster of periods where it would be in remission, and we'd feel great, only to see it come back, and we'd be terrified. My mother, Jan, now in her 80s, was always very, very smart. Still is, of course, but very, very smart. Tough as hell, and she had a plan. She knew that it not only would eventually get worse before it got better, but ultimately that it might not get better at all. So she prepared herself for a war. Jan worked very hard in the family business, and she and Jay were a great team together. But Jan, and I mean this in a very good way, Jan didn't mind a cocktail after work, as she would prepare dinner for us as a family every single night. She was great like that. She worked long, long days and had long commutes, but would come home every single night and always make dinner for the family. But wouldn't mind a cocktail as she made dinner. Then her mother, my grandmother, was a very elegant gal, and she lived on the west side of Los Angeles for years, and she also was a wonderful cook. And let's just say that she and her twin sister liked a cocktail as well. So my mother, point of the story, decided in preparing for this war that she had to be locked in. And she stopped drinking altogether. She went a decade without a drink, so she would be ready, all hands on deck, for whatever was coming after that diagnosis. My father, meanwhile, through this entire period, never changed his expression. Never blinks. Never even once asked, why me? Never complains about anything he was dealing with. Never had a bad day. And believe me, there were some horrific days, painful physical procedures, painful emotional days for my mother and my sister who were dealing with it when it got really dark. Again, they were in Los Angeles and I was in San Diego. I was in San Diego doing my very best to help from a different city. I just couldn't believe that my father was carrying this incredible burden, and my mother and sister as well, but he never complained. And I know for a fact that he wanted to lead from the front. And I know that he couldn't show any weakness at all because it would only make those around him even more upset. But aside from that choice, I came to realize my father, who frankly, as much as I respected, never seemed to me to be that exceptional in any way. He just didn't. Like, people loved him, and I always thought he was just sort of this super straight-up, authentic, Boston guy. You know, tough-minded guy, tough dude. But we'd knock heads, but I didn't really get it or him. I just always thought that he was just this kind of straight-up dude. I didn't really understand, though, as I watched him battle this heinous disease and hardly ever miss a day of work, and never complain, and never show any fear, and never shed a single tear. It was only then that I came to realize that he really was exceptional. I never thought so, but he was exceptional, and was in fact one of the baddest mother bleepers I'd ever been around in my life, and I never even knew it. Because of course the cancer spreads, of course the cancer gets into his brain, and of course he needs brain surgery. Now again, this is more than 30 years ago. I'll never forget seeing them wheel my father off into surgery, and we wait hours until he comes out, and we're finally allowed to see him. And I see this enormous scar taking up half his head. And of course he's out of it, but when I visit, when we're finally allowed to visit, he's still smiling from the hospital bed, the very epitome of no bad days. They say health is wealth, and I could not agree more. That's why if you or somebody in your life is living with everyday aches and pains, I want to tell you about Relief Factor. And I'm telling you, I can feel the difference. Relief Factor is a daily supplement that helps fight pain naturally. Naturally. Now that's a big deal. Developed by doctors, Relief Factor's unique formula of ingredients all work together to help support your body's response to inflammation. Instead of masking pain for a couple of hours, Relief Factor actually helps reduce or even eliminate your pain for good. Whether it's neck, back, joint, or muscle pain, if you're looking to feel better, live better, give Relief Factor a try. In 3 weeks, you will know if it's working because you'll feel it. For instance, I was sent Relief Factor to try, and I've been taking it every single day. I'll tell you what, I feel the difference every day. Go to ReliefFactor.com or call 1-800-4-RELIEF. That's 1-800-4-RELIEF. Save on your first order. Don't let pain tell you how to live. Fight back naturally with Relief Factor. But of course, it only got worse from there. His mental condition begins to deteriorate rapidly, but incredibly, or not so incredibly, his will to fight and his battle increased exponentially the worse he got. And then finally at some point, when everybody does know, of course, by now, how sick he is, my father gathers his 100 plus employees together and tells them all that he and my mother are swapping offices. Like, my father was always the number one in the company, and my mother was the 1A. But that he makes a point of telling everybody he is swapping offices with my mother, and that my mother, Jan, would be in Jay's office, and she was going to run the company going forward, as surely she could. And Jay would still be there every single day, but in a lesser role because his health was failing. And there were so many tears that day because he was absolutely adored and beloved by his employees. They thought this dude, who never really aspired to anything great, and he would tell me that at one point, that this guy who never really aspired to anything great, my father, was actually an absolute rock star, as he'd walk the floor of this factory and of this business that he and my mother built. They loved him because he loved them, and he loved the business. So one day, I'm in my mid-20s, and Jay is still lucid enough. He's ill. He's very ill. But he's still lucid enough and has his faculties enough that he and I go to lunch together one day in Los Angeles. And we have a beer together for the first time ever. True story. I never had a beer with my father until I was in my mid-20s. Per usual, he doesn't want to make it about him. And he tells me how proud he and Jan are of me and what I'm accomplishing in my business. And I finally just blurt something to the effect out of, holy shit, Jay. He had me calling him Jay back in the day when I worked for him. Holy shit, Pop. Like, I don't get it. He looks at me and he says, you don't get what? And I say, all of it. All of it. How are you not freaking out? How are you okay with all of this? How are you not afraid? How do you never complain? How do you never once say, why me? The fuck is going on here anyway, Dad? Like, I'm losing it. How are you handling this the way you are? And he just smiled at me and he said, take it easy, Jimmy. I'm good. I'm good. And that triggered me all over again. I said, I know. This is exactly what I mean. This is my point. How the fuck are you good? You have leukemia. You're in your 50s. You've had brain surgery. How are you good? How are you not depressed? And I'll never forget what he told me. He said, number one, I've only been depressed 2 times in my entire life. And now I'm thinking to myself, you've only been depressed 2 times in your entire life. You have leukemia and you've had brain surgery and that didn't depress you. I can't imagine what the 2 times in your life must have been that depressed you. But then the second thing he said stopped me dead in my tracks. He said, also, I'm good because I never expected to have the life that I have. I never expected to marry somebody as amazing as your mother. I never expected to have 2 amazing kids. I never expected to have a successful business that I love. I never expected or really aspired to any of this. yet I have it all, so I'm good. I've lived a life that far exceeded any of my expectations. I'm thrilled. I'm grateful. I have gratitude, and I will continue to live that life, and I will continue to be grateful for all these things that I never expected. And I just sat there in shock. And the ensuing years, as you might imagine, were horrific, and they were terrifying as his condition worsened. He lost his faculties. We would have to hide his car keys from him because he would try to sneak out and drive himself to work without even knowing that he couldn't actually operate a moving vehicle anymore. That was really scary, the thought of him being on the road, but he wanted to go to work. So my mother throws him a 60th birthday party at their ranch in San Ynez, California. And people come from far and wide. They come from out of state. They come from all over to celebrate with Jay. And of course, probably to say their goodbyes. And as ill as he was at that time, maybe he knew, maybe he didn't. But he was just so happy and had the time of his life seeing all the people that meant so much to him. Keep in mind, this is somebody who never, ever, ever wanted anything for himself, ever. But he loved that party. And then he ultimately passed away not long thereafter. The purpose of telling the story is the lessons I learned as he was what I thought was just this average person, attacked the monster with ferocity and courage and dignity and most of all, gratitude and this incredible mindset. All of those lessons from back then, decades ago, have stayed with me forever. I don't always practice them, but they've stayed with me. And I know for a fact that positivity kept him alive much longer than it should have. I know that that fearless mindset kept him alive much longer than it should have. He fought with everything he had until the very last minute because while he was never afraid of dying, he loved life that much and he loved his life and everybody around him. And he was just so grateful and he had so much gratitude for everything he had. And it took me such a long time to understand that. How can you have gratitude when your life is being ripped from you in your 50s? Like, he was never a material person at all. Personally, I always loved the shiny things. And he even would always buy my mother, who also worked hard, so she paid for it too. But my mother, for instance, always loved Porsches. But he was never about that. And to this moment, I often think that my father, I think about him when I allow myself to get hooked by something really stupid. Or I often think about how he probably had less than what I've had, but he had such a greater appreciation and attitude and mindset and perspective than I have ever had. And that he could attack cancer and never once complain and never ask why me and never have a bad day and never lash out. And I think to myself, the hell am I doing complaining about the most moronic things ever? How was he so much more grateful and so much tougher mentally, emotionally, and physically than I've ever been? And I know for a fact I could never endure what he did with that sort of grace and courage and toughness and dignity. So, as I try to reinvent myself for this next chapter of my life and my business, I think to myself frequently, what would Jay do? What would Jay think? And the answer is, he really wouldn't think or overthink it at all. He would just go. He would just do. He would just take action. And he would never complain. And he'd be grateful for a life that I always thought ended way too soon, but one that he thought was not only complete, but way beyond expectation and comprehension. Although it ended right after he turned age 60 and pretty horrifically. Although we didn't always see eye to eye, and I thought that he didn't know how it really was plenty of times, in retrospect now as I look back, of course, he knew way better than I knew. And in the end, he was one of the toughest people I have ever known. And I only hope to be able to exhibit half that toughness, half that grace, and half that dignity when it does go down, because it will. love and respect to a man that I wish you could have all known, because virtually everybody who ever met him did love him. Now, I know that's a lot. That's a lot. And that's heavy. And because of that, that conversation, that there alone, could have been a standalone ep. And this next conversation that I'm about to have could be a standalone ep. But I decided not to break them into two. Hey, listen, I've got to tell you guys about this. So the other day, I come across a product that all of us should be carrying around, a product that I now carry around. It's something different for fresh breath. It's this amazing product called Zelman's Minty Mouth. And guys, it is an absolute game changer. If you're up in the grill of somebody else making your case for whatever it is, make sure your breath is fresh. If it's not, they won't hear what you're selling or saying anyway. Zelman's cleans your breath in a way that other mints don't and can't, because it's not just a mint. It's a functional breath freshener capsule that you swallow, clinically tested against the toughest offenders like garlic and onions even. You just pop two or three in your mouth, you suck the minty coating, then swallow the capsule for the confidence of fresh, clean breath that lasts for hours. This product is like nothing else you've ever tried. It fights bad breath in your mouth, and then it goes down to your gut. This is the ultimate hack to get rid of coffee, garlic, or smoker's breath. It's that strong. You're going to love having the confidence of long-lasting fresh breath or your money back. That's right, or your money back guaranteed. These folks will give you your money back. Not that you'll want it, but they will. They have free shipping if you order three packs or more. And trust me, you're going to want more. And nobody likes to pay for shipping, right? So go to Zelmans.com right now. That's Zelmins.com right now. Do it now and you'll get 15% off when you use my promo code ROME. That's Zelmins.com. But you have to use the code ROME, R-O-M-E, to get your 15% savings. Do it. Do it right now. I want it to be one full episode. That way you can go back to it if you ever need to and listen to it once again and share with others who you think might need to hear it. Steven Panis is a friend of mine. He's a business associate of mine, and we met in the horse racing business. Steven is a high-ranking marketing executive in that sport, extremely well-respected, and Janet and I owned and raced thoroughbred horses for a number of years. We still do to a certain extent. As mentioned, Steven suffered the unthinkable nightmare that every parent is most terrified of. Terrified of getting that phone call telling you of the death of a child. Steven tells this story in a brand new book called Walk On. It depicts the unthinkable grief that he and his family have suffered as a result of losing their beloved son, Jake, and the steps that he has taken to pick himself up, carry on, and make sure that Jake's legacy lives on. It is episode 85 of The Reinvention Project with guest Steven Panis, and it's coming at you right now. Steven, it is so good to get the chance to get caught up and have you share you and your family's story. My brother, how are things? How are you?
I'm still standing. You know, I'm walking on, as they say. I'm doing all right, Jim. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, it's great to have you. We'll talk about that notion of walking on. A little background, Steven. You and I are good friends. So, of course, I know you well. I know your family, just as you know my wife, Janet. You know our boys. So, of course, I know of your family's journey. I'm sure a number of people listening, Steven, know as well. But for those who don't, tell me about the Panis family and tell me about what life was like for you all prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, so my wife is Kelly, and we have two boys, Jake, and who's our firstborn, and then Liam, who's 5 years younger. And we were just, you know, like any other family, we were happy. The boys were happy. They were in school. Jake, prior to 2020, Jake was just entering. He was in high school. He was, he was going to be a junior. Liam was in middle school. And we have really no complaints. And then the pandemic came, like, for everybody, and the world changed for us in more ways than one.
Steven, your lives changed forever on August 9th, 2020. Can you share what happened that day?
Yeah, so we had let Jake go away on a weekend getaway with his girlfriend of about 5 weeks and her family. It's a Block Island. It's about 2 hours away in Rhode Island, a little tiny island off Rhode Island. And it's the last text from the mother was, who was the girlfriend's mother, was, "Nothing to worry about. I'll be watching the kids." 2 days later, we got a phone call on Sunday around 1 in the afternoon that said there was an accident. Jake was injured, and those were all the details that were related to us. So Kelly, Liam, and I hopped into our car and began to speed towards Rhode Island. Again, it was a 2 hour drive. We were 12 minutes into the drive when the phone rang, and it was on speakerphone, and it was a doctor from Rhode Island. He introduced himself. He paused, and then he said, "I'm sorry, but I just pronounced your son dead." And everything went black.
I mean, Stephen, it's without question, it's every single parent's worst nightmare. I can't even imagine what you do in that moment, how you begin to process that. You just said that everything went black. How long did everything stay black? What did you do from that moment going forward?
Well, I was flying down the road. I was probably going 85. I had to get from the left lane over to the right lane and to get off that highway because I had no business being on the road at that point. And so I did that. We maneuvered our way over, got off at the first exit. Again, it was a Sunday, so I drove into an entry straight ahead. Right off the exit was a bank, and the parking lot was empty. We drove into that, and I just slammed it in park. We all kind of got out of the car, started screaming, running in circles, and we just fell. Hugging each other is just one broken blob of humanity. And just, the doctor was still on the line, but I couldn't hear anything he was saying. It's so hard to describe, Jim. The feelings are both, you're feeling something, but you're completely unsure what it is, and you're numb at the same time, and your head's about to explode.
Stephen, with respect to what happened, can you describe or share any of the details of the accident? What did that involve?
Yeah, so we found out later that night the details of the accident, and what happened was Jake and some buddies and his girlfriend spent this morning at the beach. They had all been drinking. They came back to the house, and the mother handed the keys to her SUV to her daughter and let everyone get in the car. She also put her other son in the car, who needed to be dropped off at a kayak shop. And despite the kids having been drinking, and apparently pretty obvious that they had been drinking for unknown reasons, they were put in the car. And next thing you know, there was an accident. The driver was charged with reckless driving, going off the road, hitting a telephone pole, and driving under the influence. Jake was the only one killed of the five people in the car, and the driver was his teenage girlfriend.
Stephen, I want to talk to you all about Jake in one moment, but in terms of processing this, I wonder how you process that part of it. Is forgiveness a part of this? How do you reconcile the fact that this adult put the keys in this young person's hands? How have you handled that and processed that, and what have you done with that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. It took a while, and a grief is a personal journey, despite the fact that my wife and I share this journey and Liam shares it with us. We each have our own way of processing, coping, compartmentalizing. For me, I had to get over anger, bitterness. I even blame myself because, as a father, and I'm sure you can relate to this, we're supposed to protect our kids and protect our family. And I pointed the finger at myself right away, like, "Oh my God, I failed as a father." And it took a couple weeks to get over that, to realize, well, wait a minute, I wasn't even there. I didn't have anything to do with it. I raised my son right, and he wasn't behind the wheel. It just, but then when I got past that, I realized my way forward from this and to lighten my load was I had to forgive everybody. And there's a great quote by theologian Lewis Smedes that says, "To forgive is to set a prisoner free, and you discover that the prisoner was yourself." And when I was able to do that, I realized how much freer I became. How I was able to move forward with my life and focus on more positive things. I'm not a negative person by background. I'm very optimistic and Grew up with a lot of inspiration from my parents, who were very encouraging, so I was blessed that way. And I needed every ounce of that to get off the floor that I was knocked down on from this tragedy.
I know you are like that, and you and I have worked together and shared time together socially. You've always been like that. So now I need to know. Tell me all about Jake, Steven. What was Jake like?
Jake was magnetic. He was rare from the get-go. We didn't even have a name for him. Jim, when he was first born, we were still debating names, but he came out with a full head of hair, so much that some of it ran down his side of his face. It looked like he had sideburns. And we kind of looked at each other, Kelly and I, and we said, "There's okay, that's Jake. He's a Jake." He had a full head of hair, blonde, curly afro that men and women loved and would have killed for. But he just had an infectious personality. He was an extrovert on steroids. He loved people, loved being around large gatherings, liked to lift people up, great sense of humor, natural leader, natural all-around athlete. And he spread loved to spread joy. Just a great, great kid who was mature beyond his years. At age 5, he was comfortable talking to adults, looking people in the eye. We took him everywhere. And I'm sure you did with your boys. I took Jake at age 5. I took him to the Indianapolis 500 when I represented Elio Castroneves. And we just had a lot of great father-son experiences like that because he loved sports. He was there when American Pharoah won the Triple Crown. We were sitting with Carson Daly and Willie Geist, and his eyes popped out of his head when everybody started flipping tables and throwing glasses and celebrating. And but at the end of the day, I think he was more excited that we won an $800 trifecta that day than American Pharoah winning the Triple Crown. But he just was a great kid to be around, and he touched so many lives. We lived in every time zone, and so Jake had friends all over this country.
Yeah, Stephen, I love that you guys have those experiences and you'll always have those memories. For instance, like that's the kind of person he was. What types of hopes and dreams did Jake have? What were his plans?
Yeah, so he wanted to follow in my footsteps and attend the University of South Carolina. That was one of his dreams. He was working hard on it. He had just taken his first practice SAT exam and scored like a 1340 on it. So he was getting everything lined up to fulfill his dream. And obviously that didn't happen. It's tough to people have asked me, "Hey, what do you think Jake would have been?" And he was 16 years old, and I didn't know what I wanted to be at 16, really. He was in the process of figuring that out. One thing that I do recall is he did mention, I have a cousin who's an FBI agent, and he mentioned that in the summer of 2020 early. And so one of the last movies he and I watched together was Silence of the Lambs. I do remember that.
You know, Steven, I was going to answer the question. I was going to say, what was he going to be? You're right. They're so young. Like Logan just started his first year at Colorado and he has no idea what he wants to do. I would say, knowing what you've said about Jake, what would he have done? Probably anything he wanted. Probably anything he
Yeah.
wanted. Janet will love that story about him wanting to be an FBI agent because whenever we watch true crime, Janet always says, "Man, I am so fascinated by those guys and gals and what they do." She loves the notion of the FBI agents and the work that they do. You know, the thing about Jake, so he had a dream, and the dream was to go to the University of South Carolina. He loved that school. He loved that football program. Not long after he was hired as the football coach there, Stephen, Shane Beamer called you one day. What did he want to talk to you about?
Yeah, so it was 2 days before Christmas 2020, and my wife and I went for a walk because we needed to get out of the house. It was a very joyless Christmas season for us that year, and we took a long walk. I left my phone at home, which was out of the ordinary, but I just needed a break. And we got home, and I looked at my phone, and there was a 843 number, which is a prefix for South Carolina, and I thought it was probably a college buddy calling to cheer me up. And there was a voicemail. I played it. And lo and behold, it was Shane Beamer. He's 2 weeks on the job, and he was calling to reach out. He had heard the news of Jake and just wanted to talk to Liam and myself and really check in on Liam. And I called him back. He was actually interviewing a coach and said, I'm on the line interviewing a coach. Give me an hour. I'll call you guys back. And he did. We FaceTimed, and it was really powerful, Jim. He was very concerned for Liam. And he reminded me a lot of Jake in that moment. He was just really looking out for Liam, wanted to know how he was doing, really cared, and the level of humanity that came through was meaningful, and it kicked off an idea in my head as Jake's father. I wanted to get him to the University of South Carolina somehow, some way, and that's the genesis of the idea of let's create this walk-on scholarship at South Carolina. And 3 weeks later, I reached back out to Shane with the idea. He's a former walk-on himself at Virginia Tech, so it immediately resonated with him. And it took off. We raised a ton of money, and we have an endowed scholarship now at the university. And in 3 years, we've awarded three scholarships to young men, great young men, all academic SEC kids that are good on the field and equally better off the field. And that was the goal, was to have a scholarship that captured Jake's leadership qualities, his grit and his toughness, and someone that cared about their community, both on the field and off. And Coach Beamer's been great. The university's been fantastic and supporting it. And Gamecock Nation has been amazing.
That whole thing is amazing. That is tremendous. It is tremendous that Shane Beamer did that and that you and he could work together to establish that scholarship and that legacy continues on. You know, Stephen, the book, Walk On, the title of the book, Walk On, can mean a number of different things. In this particular case, what does it represent to you and why did you choose that for the title?
Yeah, for me, it represents what I needed to do to recover and get back into life because I was knocked down. I was out for a good year. I felt like a misfit in society. It felt like life was just passing me by and I couldn't engage. My wife was struggling. My son was struggling. They didn't want to live. I had a lot on my plate and I was trying to hold my family together. I was trying to hold myself together and keep life. Keep us engaged as best I could and keep hope alive, even though it was just glimmers of it for months. Yeah, just space, and that's the grief brain right there. Welcome to grief, right? I lose my thought a lot.
Right. You know, when you, let me help you with that. When you began to write that book, Stephen, did you not initially begin to write it for Liam, who was struggling greatly with the loss of his big brother? And then secondarily, how's he doing now? And how were he and Jake? What were they like together?
Yeah, I did write it initially. Initially, I wrote it to survive myself. And then I recognized that I looked at Liam one day and he was struggling. First 2 years, Liam had a hard time. He missed his brother. They were polar opposites. Jake was the extrovert, Liam the introvert. Jake loved sports. Liam wasn't as keen on sports. Jake was loud. His beat was fast. Liam was quiet. He liked to be hidden by camouflage. He loves the military. Despite the fact that they were opposites, they were so close. Liam adored him, looked up to him, and Jake was his protector and just took him under his wing and tried to teach him everything he knew. And just when Jake found out he was going to be a big brother, he literally jumped off the chair, ran across our couch, his arms up in victory, screaming with joys of ecstasy. Jake wanted like 15 more brothers. But he loved Liam and they had a great relationship. And the way I looked at it was I was 51 years old when this tragedy happened and I was blown to smithereens. And I looked at Liam and I was like, this kid's 11. How is he? I can't handle it. How's he supposed to handle it? So one day I took him outside and I asked him to bring his buck knife out. And we walked across our property to an old mature tree. And I said, why don't you carve out a square on this bark off this tree? And he kind of looked at me quizzically and he did it. And he goes, okay, what now? And I said, well, now you're going to watch this tree regrow bark and heal itself. And just like this tree, you and I are going to regrow new parts of our heart and we're going to heal ourselves too. And it's going to be different. I'm not going to lie to you. It's going to look different, feel different, but we are going to heal. And a year later, he came running across to me. He's like, Dad, look, the bark grew back. And Liam's doing great now. He's a freshman in high school. He's actually running track. I'm on the high school track and field team. I couldn't be prouder of him. He's emotionally evolved for his 15 years on this planet. He's been through a lot. But he's a good kid with a bright future.
What an incredible story that is. What an amazing anecdote that is about the buck knife and the tree. Stephen, like you were talking about grief, and I want to ask you about grief. You say grief is, quote, an unwelcome topic in our society, end of quote. How so, and in your opinion, how should we process and treat grief as a society?
Yeah, well, in our society, we don't want to talk about it. It's a stigma, you know. It scares the living shit out of people, to be perfectly honest. I mean, when we hear someone close dies to us, they are foreign feelings that take over our body. We often go into shock. It's just something that people evade. And I know it personally now as a bereaved parent. People are not comfortable sometimes talking to me, and you can sense it right away. Or people look at me and they're like, oh, that's the bereaved dad. And that's not a title anybody wants. So I try to break it down for people and just keep it simple. Like, hey, look, just show up. And grief is just one form of adversity, and we're all struggling in some way. We all have this invisible backpack of crap that we're carrying. And if we could look at one another like that, we'd have more compassion and we'd show up. You know, you can fake a lot of things in life, Jim, but you can't fake not showing up. And people, when you have a friend or family member going through something like this, show up. You don't even have to say anything. You just have to be there for them, be present. We had some amazing things happen. I had a guy mow my lawn for like 3 months. I had people walk our dogs. We had a meal train for over a year and like a month and a half, I think it was. It was crazy, the amount of support. But there's a million ways you can support people. And it is an awkward topic. I'll own that. Nobody wants to bring the person down even more, bring it up. But, you know, it's okay to check in and just say, how you doing? You know, is there anything I can help you with? Or just do it. Because sometimes they'll say, no, I'm good, when they're really not good. But just be there for people, because that's what they really need. They need to know that they're not alone.
Such a powerful message. Such a powerful message. You know, as you just said, Stephen, everybody is dealing with something. Everybody is suffering on some level. Everybody is hurting. So my question would be, if we're all hurting or suffering and we're all looking for answers, it seems like we're looking for answers that are outside of us. Is that where the answers are found? Are the solutions external?
Not at all. The exact opposite. And that's kind of the thesis of my book, which is that the answers are inside each one of us. We just have to mine them and source them. But they're all there. It's frustrating when I see people looking for happiness from an external thing or material thing. And that just is fleeting. We create our own happiness. And ultimately, the quality of our mindset architects the quality of our life. So you can choose to be negative and bitter, but guess what's going to come from it? It's like I taught my boys, your choices equal your consequences. And so I'm a big believer in, you have to think positively. You have to put it out there. I mean, if you don't believe it can happen, how the hell is it supposed to happen? So it starts with you. And the most important relationship you're going to have on this planet is with yourself.
Yeah, Stephen, I've done this podcast now for, well, a few years now. And this has been the main theme of the entire podcast, The Reinvention Project. It's your mindset determines the quality of your life. Everything flows from your mindset without question. It seems amazing to me that Jake had such a great, great mindset as such a young person. And as you point out, he was wise and mature beyond his years. If Jake were here right now, what do you think, even as a young person, what do you think his message to those listening would be?
Man, I use one word always to describe Jake, and that was authentic. And he would tell people, you are born with one obligation, and that's to be authentically who you are. So be it.
Again, how do you explain somebody that age coming around to that? I mean, there are people, I didn't come around to something like that, so I was much older. There are people, Stephen, that never, ever come around to anything like that. How did he know that at such a young age?
Grace of God is what I can come up with. Like I said, he was just special from the second he popped out. And he just constantly blew us away. And I hate to sound like that parent that says, oh, you just stood there and observed and marveled at him. But there were times where my wife and I would literally stand in the back of the room and just look at each other, but like, how did this happen? Like, who created this kid? Because it was mind-blowing at times for someone so young to be so deep in thought, and he cared so much about people around him. And he, like, when he went out to South Dakota on his mission trip, with our church his freshman year of high school, he came back upset and pissed off at the inequalities that he witnessed and the differences in his life and in the kids, like the Lakota children out there and how they lived. And he wanted to make a difference. And that was the first thing he said to me when he got off the bus, "Dad, we got to help these folk."
Yeah, it is amazing. I think that there he was one of one. He was one of a kind. But I think parents listening right now certainly have had those moments where they sit back and they're like, "Man, that kid, that child, like, where did that kid come from? Didn't come from us. Didn't come from us."
Yeah,
You know, so
exactly.
I think I do understand what you're talking about. In fact, I know I understand. If somebody's listening, Stephen, right now, and they've lost somebody close to them, or something's happening and the world is caving in, and they simply feel like they do not have the strength to go on, because you certainly had your moments, your days, your weeks, your months like that. What would you tell that person?
I would say tell somebody right away so that you can get some help. Get therapy. It's good to, and I say this in the book, Jim, our strength is our vulnerability. And that's a difficult concept, especially for a man. And it took me a while to kind of really embrace that. But when I learned that I could be powerful by sharing exactly what I was feeling and offloading it and making sense of it, and using it to evolve and grow is when I really turned a corner. So I think you got to find your support, whether that's family, friends, church, therapist, lean on them. You have a choice, right? Yeah, it really comes down to this. You don't control what happened to you, and you don't control what happens in life, but you control what you feel and do about what happens to you. So for me, it was that simple. I was at that crossroads and I looked and I said, okay, I can wallow in darkness, go down a really dark path, or I can crawl. I can crawl towards the light. And that's what I did, one day at a time. And that's the other thing I'd say, take it slow. There's only one day that matters, and that's today. Yesterday already happened. Can't change it. Tomorrow, it's not guaranteed. I tell Liam that all the time. Let's maximize today because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. In fact, we already got a glimpse of what the hell can happen tomorrow. And I didn't like it, and I'm sure you didn't. So let's maximize today. And that's all we're given.
You know, I would walk off on that and let them know where to purchase walk on, no pun intended. But I want to ask you about one last thing, Stephen, that just crossed my mind. There's something else you write about in the book, and you write about the importance of turning pain into purpose. We've been talking around this kind of throughout this entire conversation, but can you address that for a minute? The importance of turning pain into purpose, and maybe share the process behind that. How do you do that?
Well, it is a process. It took a while. When Jake lost, I lost. When Jake died, I lost my purpose, a central part of my purpose. Obviously, Father and Liam still there, but the void was massive, and the pain was the most intense I've ever had in my life. Grief is my shadow. You can try to suffocate it. You can try to ignore it. It's there knocking on your door every morning and every night. The process was to lean on all the things that I could control. I could control my effort. I could control whether I forgave people. I could control whether I had gratitude or not. I could control whether I believed in myself, that I would get out of this situation, that we over time things would improve. I could control my enthusiasm, my joy. And so that's what I focused on. I really tried to simplify my life and focus on the few things that I did control, because we feel like we control a lot on this planet, and it's just an illusion. When we narrow it down and realize that the little we do, we focus on that, you can then take that pain and start to reshape it. And I'll say this too, I do read a lot about Buddhism, and the Buddhists say you got to lean into the sharp points. And the Native Americans have a great saying that the buffalo is the only known animal that will turn into a storm to get through it. And I think there's a great lesson there for humans. Is that if you are facing some form of adversity, and whatever that is, and grief is just one form of adversity, there's many, you have to face it. You have to confront it, and you have to push through it to get out. You can't hide, you can't try to run around it. You got to go through it. And if you go through it, and it is a process, and I'm not going to lie to you, it's painful. There's going to be some grueling grueling days, but you can do it. People can do it. And the answers are all within them. And like I said, we all suffer in some way, shape, or manner, but we can all walk on too and find a way to do that.
Oh, man, that is so good. That is so great. And it's often said that the only way out is straight through. And I love this notion of leaning into the sharp points or sharp edges, and that the buffalo will often turn into the storm to get through the storm. This is all amazing. The book is called Walk On. It's an incredible read. I would urge everybody to get it. Stephen, if somebody listening, either an individual, maybe a company, or otherwise, wants to reach out to you, because I know that you are working within the community and you are doing other things to help spread the word and to help, how would they reach you directly?
Yeah, so I have a website, stephenpanis.com. They can there's a contact thing, send me an email there. I'd love to talk to anybody and everybody. I'm just trying to help people. Like I said, the book was supposed to help Liam. I think it's done that. Hopefully it can help others. And the book's available via Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, Target, you name it. And I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about it today, Jim. And I want to say I really appreciate your support. You've been a great friend for me through this process. You've supported the scholarships, you and Janet, and I can't thank you enough, my man.
My brother, I want to say to you, I have great admiration for you and for your turning this immense pain into purpose, for spreading a message of hope, of love, of gratitude. I know that Jake is with you and yours, always will be in spirit, in your hearts. His legacy will live on forever. I know that you'll ensure that. So nothing but love and respect, my brother. As difficult as this must be, it was so good to get caught up. I'm so glad we could connect. I'm so glad we could have this time together. I know we'll do it again soon. I appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Jim, and best to Janet and the boys.
Now, once again, I know that's a lot. I know that's a really, really heavy episode. I also know that maybe many of you who are listening are either suffering to some extent or going through something. And I hope that listening to that could help you in some way and perhaps give you a fresh perspective and maybe a way to reframe your current experience, whatever it is. My great thanks to Stephen Panis for sharing his and his family's story of Jake, their forever devotion to him and his legacy. And I would encourage you once again to get his new book. It's called Walk On. And if you think anybody listening to this episode might benefit from it, please do share it. And if you haven't already, please do review the pod and hit the subscribe button. That way, you never need to go looking for the latest episode. It will find you instead. As always, I appreciate your support greatly, and I will find you next time right here on the Reinvention Project with Jim Rome.